It is also possible to have success and then walk into a totally unanticipated failure later. So be wary of change. But like, what other things are you doing that you are taking for granted as a given, but are the result of a totally maybe random or lucky guess?
Welcome to another episode of Famous Failures, where it's my job to interview the world's most interesting people about their failures and what they learned from them. I'm your host, Ozan Varol. Today's guest on the show is Neil Pastricha. Neil is the author of 5 New York Times bestsellers, including The Book of Awesome, which is a catalog of simple pleasures based on Neil's 50 million hits award-winning blog, and The Happiness Equation, a 9-step guidebook to happiness based on new research. Neil's books have been on bestseller lists for over 200 weeks and sold millions of copies. Neil is also one of the most popular TED speakers, with his first TED Talk, which is called The 3 A's of Awesome, ranked as one of the most inspiring of all time. Neil's new podcast, which is called 3 Books, discusses the most formative books of inspiring individuals from all walks of life. Neil's work has been featured in hundreds of outlets, including CNN, BBC, The Today Show, The Early Show, The Oprah Winfrey Network, Harvard Business Review, Fast Company, Fortune, Forbes, and much, much more. In the interview, we discussed the 10 years of blogging failures that helped launch Neil's viral blog, 1000 Awesome Things, the 2-minute practice that Neil uses every morning to build more gratitude into his life, why focusing on external validation ends up leaving us unhappy, and what we can do about it, and what Neil learned from launching his new podcast, 3 Books. Before I start the conversation, as always, if you're enjoying the show, please take a moment to rate and review the podcast on iTunes and Google Play. I don't do any advertisements or sponsors on the show, so I depend on the goodwill of listeners like yourself to help spread the word. In addition, if you'd like to keep in touch with me, you can sign up for my weekly newsletter, The Weekly Contrarian, by going to my website, ozanvarol.com/newsletter. And just dropping in your email address every Thursday morning, you'll get a short email from me with an article, a quote, a tool, other gems that challenge conventional wisdom and help us change the way that we view the world. And if you're not driving, you can also text my first name, O-Z-A-N, that's Ozan, O-Z-A-N, to 345-345, and I'll send a newsletter to you, along with a copy of my ebook, The Contrarian Handbook, 8 Principles for Innovating Your Thinking, for free. Without further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Neil Pastricha, and thank you, as always, for listening. Neil, welcome to the show.
Ozan, thank you so much for having me.
So I want to go back in time to 2008. For the listeners who are not familiar with your background, when you made your first big splash on the internet with your blog, 1000awesomethings.com. Tell us a little bit about the blog and also what prompted you to start it.
Well, really, it was 2 failures. It was the failure of my marriage. One day I came home from work and she told me she didn't want to be married anymore. She didn't love me anymore. And we were 2 years in, we had no children in a way, luckily, but it was still like a staggering blow psychologically and emotionally. And I had to sell a house and process a divorce. And as that was actually happening, I lost my best friend. So my best friend, Chris, was one of the 4 people in the US, or one of the 4 people in Canada, where I'm from, who suffered from mental illness. And in the throes of that divorce happening, he took his own life. And I call that a failure just because of his potential. But in a sense, you know, suicide is this gigantic, complex thing. So I don't want to project that word failure onto him in any way. He's a beautiful, beautiful person. But they were 2 huge, giant blows. I was writing a eulogy for Chris's funeral at the same time as I'm selling a house, at the same time as I'm trying to find a place to live. And so the swirl of negativity that I was surrounded in felt totally all-encompassing. I was ensconced in negative thoughts. And one day on my drive home to work, my drive home from work, I was working at Walmart. I did a role in leadership there for 10 years. I was driving home from Walmart and I thought to myself, like, I just need a way to change the channel. I got to change the channel in my brain. So as you pointed out, I started a blog called 1000awesomethings.com as a way to put a smile on my face every night before bed. I'd come home and I'd write about finding $5 in your coat pocket, or playing on the rusty, old, dangerous playground equipment, or getting both, you know, armrests at the movie theaters, you know, you sort of sharp elbow the other guy away. Whatever it was, I would just write these little essays. And I did that for 1,000 straight weekdays to cheer myself up.
Do you have a, and this might be like asking if you have a favorite child, but do you have a favorite awesome thing from that list of 1,000?
I do have a favorite child. I think anyone, any parent that says they don't is really actually lying. Deep in their heart, they really do feel like, oh, that one doesn't give me any hassle. That one like gives me kisses at night. Anyway, I'm joking, although I am a dad and I could kind of go on a little rant about that favorite child story. What I would say is the other side of the pillow is the awesome thing that I sort of love because it's free, it's simple, it's universal. Almost everyone has a pillow, young or old, rich or poor, black or white, right wing or left wing. You got a pillow. And so you know the great joy that comes with tossing and turning at 3 a.m. on your hot, disgusting, sweaty pillow and flipping it over to the cold side. And so that epitomizes what I was trying to do with 1000awesomethings.com, which is why I selected it to be the opening entry in the Book of Awesome, or the first book that was created from my blog. Essentially just my blog stapled together in a book. It's the Book of Awesome.
And where does your sense of wonder or appreciation of small things come from? I mean, did it predate the two failures you identified, the loss of your marriage and then the tragic loss of your friend, or did it postdate those events?
Yeah, well, first of all, I think we all have that sense of wonder. It's deep inside us and we just lose it, right? So like the thing that was different about me in some sense was when I was experiencing the sense of wonder that a five-year-old has, like, I'm like, oh my gosh, it's snowing. So was my dad at the same time, because he was this poor East Indian immigrant, came over with $8 in his pocket to North America in the 1960s, you know, literally hard scrabble roots. His mother died when he was 3. And he was like, oh my God, there's snow outside the window. So I just never realized that no one ever tamped out my childlike sense of wonder, because my dad was experiencing it at the same time. So he would be like, we'd go to the grocery store and he'd be like, look at the stickers on all the apples. I was like, what do you mean? And he's like, check it out. This apple's from New Zealand. This apple's from South Africa. This apple's from Morocco. Like he was like, literally, that's how he was talking to me. And so you're on first, you're thinking like, okay, your dad was always on mushrooms. No, he was not. He was on mushrooms. He's just like an East Indian immigrant who was just like, wow. He was like blown away by the world. And so when I was in the depths of despair, and still today when I'm in the depths of despair, I simply write down gratitudes and they remind me of that sense of wonder, which is just sort of skin deep on me. And maybe it's just bone deep on other people, but we all have it. It's just about, you know, scrubbing your skin. I'm pushing the metaphor, but it's about scrubbing your skin in a certain way to just bring it back out. And that's all I was doing.
That really resonates with me because I'm an immigrant myself. I lived in Turkey for 17 years and then came to the US for college. Certainly was not in poverty like your father, but that sense of wonder, it gets re-triggered when you're put into this completely different environment, right? Because everything around you is new. And so you begin asking questions like you're 6 years old again, which is why I think, you know, international travel, foreign travel, living in foreign countries is so important, because it helps you just recapture that lost sense of wonder. Is there anything you're doing to make sure, since you're a father yourself, to instill, or I should say, since your child already has a sense of wonder, to make sure that he or she doesn't lose it?
I mean, first of all, I never, ever, ever say to them, stop asking questions. And as you know, children will ask you questions like for an hour and a half straight. Daddy, why is that bird on the telephone pole? Well, I guess it's just resting. Well, why is it resting? Maybe it's just tired. Well, why is it tired? Maybe it caught some food. Well, what food does it eat? Well, maybe it eats rats. Well, what kind of birds eat rats? And just like, you can't stop. The kid will never stop asking questions. So I'm really, really careful never to say, that's enough questions, or like, okay, that's great. Let's go. Let's go home now. I never stop it. I just never, ever stop it. And so that also means there's some other takeaways. Let's say it's like no screens at restaurants, because we want to talk at the restaurant, right? And does that make it hard? Yes, it does. When my children are screaming at a restaurant and I have to leave before dessert and I feel like a terrible dad dragging them through a restaurant, I feel like a horrible person. But also it just means that I have this big thing. I'm like, don't ever stop asking, letting them ask why. So that's one. And then the second thing I want to do is just, I have to keep it going in myself, right? So I'm the adult. I got to keep it going myself. And the way I do it is I have a 2-minute practice. Your listeners might like this because I in some of your shows, I kind of sense like this beautiful like little systems. And so one system that I've put into my life is something I call 2-minute mornings. And you can do it at morning or night. And I just answer 3 prompts for myself. I do it in a book. I actually made a journal about this called 2-minute mornings. But really, it's just three prompts. You could do it in a whatever you want piece of paper. Number one is, I will let go of, I am grateful for, I will focus on. So it's, I will let go of, crystallizing and ejecting a small anxiety, which, you know, as research proves that actually when you write it down, it disappears, which is partly why so many world religions have confession as a big part of their religion, Catholicism, Buddhism, Mormonism, Islam. It's like, because we're more secular, we don't have that anymore, unless you're going to church or you're, you know, literally getting on your knees in a Catholic confession chamber and saying, you know, you confess. If you're not doing that, or you're not mailing postcards to Post Secret, you need a place to put it. So there you go. I will let go of. Number two is, I am grateful for. So here's my daily practice, right? I'm writing down three or four things every single day that are just small pleasures that I'm grateful for, to train my brain to see them. Because I know that my brain is this elastic muscle, and unless I train it to see positive, it will naturally divert to negative, as all our brains do, because we've had 200,000 years of evolution looking for problems, because that's what led to our survival. We're awesome at finding problems. We're horrible at finding pleasures. So I have to train my brain every day. And then finally, I will focus on, what is the one single greatest thing I can do each day in order to have, you know, a day I look back on with a smile. So the purpose of that last question, I will focus on, is meant to chisel away every small annoying thing I could do in favor of the one big thing I will do.
I love this. I'm going to start working on this actually tomorrow morning. I really like the I will let go of. I think that's so important. I've been doing the gratitude list for a while, but one thing I've struggled with, and I'd love to hear your take on this, is when people create gratitude lists, and this is certainly true for me as well, the same things tend to come up again and again, right? So I'm grateful for my wife, I'm grateful for my parents, I'm grateful for my dog, and then...
That's bullshit.
Yeah.
That's total bullshit. And you know what? There's actually research behind this. We've done studies with people at universities. Yale was the partner school. And if you say that, wife, kids, dog, you're doing nothing. You actually have to come up with small, specific things that happened that day. So when my husband, Ozan, put the toilet seat down, teaching my dog, Trooper, how to shake a paw, the fact that Mr. Barney, who lives next door, actually shoveled that corner of his sidewalk so I didn't have to slip on his ice like I do every morning. Like, that type of level of detail is critical. Otherwise, it's like you're writing nothing down.
Now, on related to I will let go of, in your book, The Happiness Equation, you talk about setting goals for your earlier books that were dependent on some of these external factors, right? Like sales figures and bestseller lists. In the Happiness Equation, you mentioned essentially that you let go of that desire for external validation. Can you give us some context to that statement and why, you know, every time you achieve these external goals, you didn't quite feel as happy as you thought you would?
Sure. I mean, super easy to talk about, because I failed at my first blog ever. And I don't really talk about this blog much, actually, because everyone thinks what 1000awesomethings.com was my first blog, 2008. Actually, my first blog was created in 1996, when the internet first was covered in it was brand new out of the box. And I went away to an enrichment camp at a local college when I was still in 11th grade. And I spent a week creating a blog or a website called Neil's Haven of HTML and JavaScript. And I ended up getting 100 hits on a stat counter. And I was the first of all my friends to even have a website. No one even had the internet at home yet. What I mean? It was you might have had to get Prodigy or AOL a year later on the Compact Presario. This was early days, 1996. So it's I got a high off that. I got a high of having a website. So then I started, over the next 10 years, a ton of websites, all of which failed. I started up labelzero.com as a way to connect musicians with their fans for free. You just had to watch an ad. The only problem was I didn't know how to program, design, structure, or build a website, so it died in 10 minutes. I started up thebigjewel.com, a comedy writing warehouse where I would write comedy, which I loved doing, and try to sell my articles to magazines for syndication, which I had some experience in from a company. But of course, it totally failed and no one bought a single article. I started up ghettohouses.com at my university as a way to review all the nasty landlords who were not fixing their sinks and blah, blah, blah. And I did that with five other people. We eventually sold it to the school government for $500. So we each took home $100 and bought ourselves a couple of pizzas. But then they whitewashed the site and it just died. So I had 10 years of failed blogs. And then I started 1000awesomethings.com. And this is where your question comes in. And it started getting some traction. I wrote a post called Old Dangerous Playground Equipment. And it got posted to Fark.com, which meant that I got 50,000 hits in one day, right? Because before, like, just literally my mom was reading it. And then I was like, oh, I need to get a million hits. So I got a million hits. Like, it just, you know, got on Reddit, it got on Dig, it got on these big, you know, websites at the time, some of which are still big. And then I was like, well, if I got a million hits, like, I need to, like, win awards and, like, get 10 million hits. So then I won the award. International Academy of Digital Arts and Sciences gave me the award for best blog in the world. And I got a book deal and I got 10 million hits. And then the book came out and it hit the, like, New York Times bestseller list. And I was like, oh, well, it's going to hit, like, number one. And like, literally, I was like, my brain was like, I'm like, it's going to hit number one. So it hits, like, number one on, like, international bestseller list, New York Times bestseller list. And then it's like, oh, well, besides your book, it tells you how many weeks your book's been on the bestseller list. And my book has been on the book bestseller list for, like, 1 week or 2 weeks. And, like, I looked at the book above me, which at the time was called Oprah by Kitty Kelly. And it was, like, on the bestseller list for, like, 20 weeks. And I was like, oh, well, I need to be on the bestseller list for 20. Anyone can write a one-hit wonder. So then my book went on the bestseller list for, like, 20 weeks, and then 50, and then 100, then 200 weeks. Like I'm talking, like, years, the Book of Awesome was at the top of bestseller list. Then at that point, we're, like, from all possible explanation, you could say, like, this guy's hit a success with this first book. I could tell myself, I'm like, that monster I was on still was not fed yet. Like, that monster was still hungry. The monster wanted more food. And I'm like, how the heck is this monster still hungry? Like, I've, at this point now, hundreds of thousands, maybe a million books have passed at this point. Now it has. But I'm like, maybe at that point it's like a million books or something. And I'm like, the monster's still hungry. The monster wants more. The monster wants, you know, crazy speaking tours. The monster wants crazy book tours. The monster wants blah, 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 92nd Street Y with Malcolm Gladwell. And the monster is insatiable. And everyone's got that monster inside you. It depends how well you feed it. And more importantly, it depends how well you tame it. And the biggest thing I can teach you about how I came through this unfortunate failure of ambition, I guess you could call it, is I learned how to tame the monster. And I'm not saying I'm perfect at it. Of course, I still wrestle with that guy. He's chained up in the basement, but, you know, he's stuck there. And the way I tamed him was I drew a triangle for myself. Okay, so here's the takeaway. Here's the takeaway to tame the monster. You draw a triangle. And on one corner, you write down sales. On the other corner, you write down social. And on the last corner, you write down self. Sales, social, and self. Those are the three types of success. Sales success is obvious. It's commercial success. It's how many books you ship or how many whatever widgets you ship or whatever you're doing. Okay. Social is peer-to-peer. Okay, so it's being selected to be like the 92nd Street Y with Malcolm Gladwell. That's an example of social success. Being reviewed in the New York Times Book Review, that's a social type of success. Being in the cover of an industry magazine, winning an award, a prestigious award, getting a, you know, this doesn't pay the bills, but it's social success, social proof. And then the third one is, and by the way, a lot of people just want that. It's like, that's just fame, right? Okay. And then the third one is self. Okay. How well do you, inside yourself, feel about this thing you've accomplished? Now, my point on this triangle is it is impossible to have all three of them. So what you must do in order to tame the beast is you must pick which of the one or two corners you'll focus on in exchange of for the other one. Okay. Let me give you an example. The most popular movie of the year last year was probably some Pixar thing that did $700 million at the box office, okay? Or like some Fast and the Furious 12 or whatever, right? But that movie would have, so that's sales success, but that movie would have no Oscar. Like it wouldn't be nominated for Best Picture or anything, Fast and the Furious 12. But the movie that would win Best Picture, which is the highest form of social proof at the theater, is usually a movie like, you know, some artistic movie, right? Like it's like Moonlight or whatever, which Moonlight did like $18 million at the box office. Right. It bombed at the box office. So the question is, what would you rather make? Would you rather make a movie like The Hurt Locker, or would you rather make a movie like Alvin and the Chipmunks, The Squeakwell? That's the example I use in the book, because Alvin and the Chipmunks made $400 million and The Hurt Locker made 20, but The Hurt Locker won Best Picture. Okay, so those two things totally contradict. Very few people have both, unless you are maybe Kanye West, okay? But that guy feeds off of his total insecurity on self, right? He doesn't have the self. He talks about it. That's what he raps about. You know, look at his marriage, look at his, like, he's talking about love all the time and how he can't find it. Like, this is what he talks about. So it's like, if you build a deck in your backyard with your bare hands, you get some awesome self-success, but you aren't selling that deck and no one's reviewing that deck in, like, your neighborhood quarterly. So it's like, if you bake a cake for your kid's school, you get self. So my point is totally disentangle the types of success and then be really clear on which one you're chasing. And only then can you have some form of satisfaction.
That's great advice. So how have you applied that in your own life? In other words, how do you get yourself to focus on the self and then try to ignore as much as possible the other two nodes of this triangle, sales and social? And the reason, because this is something I struggle with too. The reason is, I'm asking is, the sales part and the social part tend to just creep in. So like if you log on Twitter, you'll see the notifications, the likes and the retweets. Sales, you get a quarterly statement from your publisher, you know, with a listing of how many books you've sold. Given that, how do you get yourself to focus on the self?
Okay, good question. And I have an answer for you. And it's very hard. Okay, so I'll give you this example. I started a new podcast. Okay, so my podcast is called Three Books. Okay, it's the world's only podcast by and for book lovers, writers, makers, sellers, and librarians. Really just anyone who likes reading or who wants to read more books. And so what I do on the show is I sit down with people like David Sedaris or Mitch Albom or Judy Blume or Chris Anderson, who runs TED or whatever. I sit down with these inspiring people. I literally sit down with them in their like actual office where they live usually. So Mitch Albom's radio station in Detroit, Chris Anderson's office in New York, David Sedaris's limo when he was in Toronto. And I ask them, what were your three most formative books? I'm starting Three Books as a podcast as a total self project, okay? I'm actually genuinely trying to uncover and discuss the 1,000 most formative books in the world. And the way I can figure out how to do that is by talking to 333 of the most inspiring people in the world and asking each of them what their three books are, okay? So I'm publishing the show on the lunar calendar, on the exact minute of every full moon and new moon. I can tell you why I'm doing the lunar calendar as a separate question if you care. But really, I'm doing that from March 27th, 2018 to September 1st, 5:52 a.m. on the exact minute of the full moon in the year 2031. This is a 14-year-long project for me. And I read each of the three books before I interview the person. So it's like also I'm reading 1,000 books on top of all my regular stuff. But why am I doing this? Because I genuinely want to read more. I genuinely want to uncover these formative books. I genuinely want to sit down with inspiring people and talk to them about these things. I feel like it'll make me a better human. But how do I keep it focused on self? How do I distance myself from those creeping in sales and those creeping in social? Okay, here's how I do it. Number one, I decided to make my podcast 100% forever. Ad-free, sponsor-free, commercial-free, interruption-free. That's awesome because I don't literally have any sales to track. There are no sales. I have no CPM map, no invoicing, no woo-foo forms where I'm like trying to get like some special fancy underwear to pay me $50,000 to talk about them. No, I will not be doing that. God bless everyone who does. I love and appreciate Joe Rogan and Tim Ferriss, all these guys. Kudos to them. And by the way, more power to them. It's just not for me. I want this to be non-sales focused, so I have to have no ads. It's a really hard decision to make, Ozan, but I had to make that decision, okay? The second thing is social, okay? So that's like the iTunes rankings, okay? And don't get me wrong, I love it when Three Books cracks into the top 100 on iTunes or whatever, and like I've even like sent a couple tweets like, wow, we're a top 100 podcast, whatever. But you know what I do is I only have one employee who works for me, and her name's Kaylee. And when we started, it was like Libsyn. Okay, Libsyn, L-I-B-S-Y-N, is the like software we use to like create the podcast. And I've given her the password to Libsyn. She changed it, so I actually don't even have I have no way to access my own podcast stats. I can't even check them unless I like I'm on her computer or like I guess I text her, but I don't want to bother her. So I don't want to text her at 11 o'clock at night when my wolf inside me is like curious. I don't want to bother her. And similarly, I hired a podcast production company that I pay like $500 a month to produce the podcast, and they have access to all the other backend stuff. So the sales and the social are totally distanced from me. And how do I imbue the self, the wolf about the self? I make sure that the goal is something I really care about. I really do care on Three Books about reading 1,000 formative books, because you and me and everybody listening only has 30,000 days to live. That's the average US lifespan. So what do I want to look back on? I don't care about having a bunch of yellowed newspapers and a bunch of like little BuzzFeed articles I scrolled on when I was on the toilet. I care about reading 1,000 of the best books in the world. So I'm devoting my 14 years of my life from age 38 to age 52 to doing that.
And for those who are listening, let me also mention that Neil's podcast, Three Books, is my favorite new podcast. So I highly encourage you to check it out. And if you want a starting place, I absolutely loved the episode with Seth Godin. I think that really would be a great episode to start with. And this is coming from someone who really admires and has followed Seth's work for many, many years. And Neil's interview with Seth was the best one that I've ever heard. So I highly encourage you to start there if you're interested in checking it out. And the point, Neil, that you made about shielding yourself from, say, the Lipson statistics, it applies more generally to just breaking bad habits, distancing yourself. You know, if you're watch too much TV, putting the remote control away, locking it in a safe, just making it harder for you to access certain things makes it easier that you'll actually follow through.
It's the total metaphorical locked cookie jar, right? Like it's the putting, like another one I do similar to that is I put my iPhone charger in my basement. So I just have to annoyingly walk down to the basement to check my phone, and I'm therefore less likely to send a very nasty email at 12 a.m. when I know the next morning I actually will regret sending that email. So I just, it's not because I'm awesome, it's because I suck that I've had to make rules. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, that applies to all of us. The other thing I noticed, so 1,000 Awesome Things, you just mentioned your podcast, you're looking to get to 1,000 formative books, which is going to be over 333 podcast episodes featuring three books, and I guess plus one from somewhere. I'd love to hear about how you come up with those numbers and why you set those numerical long-term commitments.
Sure. Well, first of all, I really believe that we are alive for the blink of an eye, right? Like I am a real big proponent of living as though units of time should be measured very quickly in 10,000 years backwards, 10,000 years forwards. When I read stories about someone like Jeff Bezos of Amazon, you know, creating a clock in a rock that like dongs every 1,000 years or something like that. I might be getting the details wrong, but he's literally doing that, making the world's longest ever clock. You can like type in Jeff Bezos, like clock in a mountain, if you want to look up more. Maybe you can throw that in the show notes or something. Yeah. Most people think, well, what a crazy, weird billionaire. What I think is, what an inspiring guy, because he's tapped into something. There's actually an organization called the Long Now Foundation, and one of their big ethos is to add a zero to the front of every year. So it's not the year 2018 right now, Ozan. It's the year 02018, because they think that by adding a zero in front of the year, it gives us a better sense of place and time. And so if you believe like I do that life is infinitesimally finite and short, that we're only alive for 30,000 days, then I think it's incumbent upon us to all really feel on a daily basis, how can we live each moment like it is so special and rare and this like total explosive electrical conscious luxury that like, how can it possibly be that we're alive? And thank you to the universe for letting us be here for even just a moment. Okay. So that's how I live. And in order to help myself live that way, cause I, by the way, stub my toe, get into fights with my wife. I, you know, feel bad about yelling at my kid. Like I have all that stuff too. Like I'm a normal human, but what I do is I imbue my work, my art, with reminders, memento moris, that help me live in that conscious state of blissful awareness. So one thing I do for that is I publish my podcast, Three Books with Neil Pasricha. I publish that podcast on the lunar calendar. Why? No one else publishes their podcast on the lunar calendar. Everyone publishes on the Gregorian calendar. In fact, the iTunes algorithm doesn't even understand my publishing schedule, so I think I'm severely penalized for these things I'm releasing at like 1:21 in the morning. But why? Why do I publish on the exact minute of every full moon and every new moon? I'll tell you why. Because the Gregorian calendar is only 500 years old and we made it up. We totally made it up. It's a totally fake thing that we made up. That's why every 4 years we got to like add a day, because even in our design of it, we kind of messed up, okay? But the lunar calendar is 30,000 years old. It is grounding. It is 10,000 years in the past, 10,000 years in the future. We knew how to look up at the sky and see the time a lot longer than we knew how to like, you know, calculate leap years. So I like the fact that books and my work and my art, and at least I hope, it's grounding and it's long-term. And if I'm going to try to remind myself of that fact, then I've got to put the calendar system in to be long-term as well. That's why I made it 1,000 formative books spread out over 333 chapters or episodes over what turns out to be, when you publish on the lunar calendar, 14 years. And that's why I did 1000awesomethings.com for 1,000 straight weekdays at 12:01 in the morning. You know, from 2008, 2012, I never missed a single day because I was trying to give myself a length of rope to see a future where I could be happy while going through my divorce and loss of my friend.
That's amazing. And it's such a breath of fresh air, you know, in a space that's so crowded with podcasts that only have like 4 episodes.
Oh my God.
To see someone who's made a 14-year commitment.
They might not even be called podcasts by then. I think Apple might be bought by like, you know, Google.
Google Casts
or something. And, you know, we won't be actually downloading them. They'll just be like kind of turbo planted into our earlobes. Who knows what it'll look like. But, and by the way, that doesn't mean I can't quit the project. I won't. I mean, I know myself well enough that unless I die or something happens, I just think I'll do it. But it just helps me continue. You see, the length of rope works both ways. It both convinces everyone else that I'm going to do it and thereby adds a disproportionate amount of systemic pressure on myself to actually do it. There will be, I'm sure, many days and months and years where I want to quit because I'm overburdened. But the mapping route actually helps me continue.
And another project that you recently started, which I read about online, is how you're challenging yourself to do one weird project or tackle one weird thing each month. And you wrote that you're doing that because you're looking for failure. Why is that? So why are you looking for failure?
I mean, it's the best form of learning, right? It's the best form of growth. If I look back on all those 8 terrible websites that I just told you about that all failed, they led into 1000awesomethings.com, which turned into a 50 million hit website, 2 Webby Awards, 5 book deals off of that one website, and still no ads off the website. So how did I just start that website? Well, everyone thinks, that guy just got lucky. He just wrote down things he liked and it got viral. No, man. I failed for 10 years making blogs that I learned something from every single time. And so the problem is, and this is a big problem in life in general, especially I think with your listeners, because I know some of your, you know, listeners are probably like successful people. And the problem with success is it sends you down the line of doing stuff that makes money and that is constantly successful. And that makes you more brittle and makes you more fragile to failure. So what I mean is, if you suddenly back into selling real estate and it turns out you're really good at selling houses and suddenly you're like $1 million a year, like real estate agent, congratulations, you make $1 million a year selling real estate. But you never actually tapped into that ballet dancing passion you had when you were 17 years old. And had you done that, not only would you have made $100 million, which you'll never know about, but more importantly, you would have been more satisfied rather than being in homes in the suburbs on Saturday mornings trying to get people to buy a house and baking cookies. You might have been on a stage at Carnegie Hall doing pirouettes and inspiring people through your art. You don't know that though, because you never tried, because you got successful selling their houses early. So you stopped trying your ballet dancing. And you don't know what would have come if you'd really persevered through a more and more failure and more learning.
And how do you personally make sure that you'll learn from failure? And the reason I ask that is, I mean, I do a lot of speaking on failure to different corporations and groups and institutions. And of course, there are exceptions, but generally speaking, are really not good at learning from failure. Because when failure happens, well, when success happens, we tend to say, oh, we're so talented, we're so skilled, we're so great at what we do. When failure happens, we tend to blame external actors, right? We say, well, you know, it was bad luck, our funding dried up, you know, we were ahead of the voters, you know, you name your favorite external reason.
Well, can I say a hypothesis, which
sure.
I won't be able to prove or disprove, but maybe you could tell me if I'm on the right track. I suspect that you're being hired to speak at successful organizations. And what I mean by that is they're profitable. They're on maybe the Fortune 500. They have some history that things used to do really well around here. And maybe they're going through disruption and they hire a speaker, or they have an annual conference and they hire a speaker, whatever. Point is, you're going in there with a message that they cannot swallow because they are too brittle and too fragile. The opposite of Nassim Taleb's anti-fragile. They're too fragile to think that that would work. However, if you go into unsuccessful organizations or organizations who have not yet felt success because they're a startup or they have a culture that just like tries and tries and tries weird things, like a Google does that or a Walmart does that, and I worked at Walmart for 10 years, so I can speak about Walmart, is Sam Walton, when he started Walmart, he sucked at most things, but he always had this belief that he was getting better and he was learning through failure. So you know what? They entered Walmart Canada. That was their first international expansion. And they failed at lots of stuff when they entered. They bought 122 existing stores. Some of them sucked. Some of them lost a lot of money. They tried a lot of things. A lot of things totally bombed, but they didn't leave Canada. They used that to springboard into Walmart Mexico. And now they're in countries around the world. Compare that to Target, a company that was very successful, based in Minneapolis, making a lot of money on the Fortune, whatever, 500, Fortune 100, something fancy. They come into Walmart Canada. They come into Canada a few years ago, and they don't make money right away. They fail at it. And you know what they do? They run away. They close all their stores. They declare bankruptcy. And listen to this. They never go and do another international expansion ever again in any country ever in their lives. They are so brittle. They're scared of themselves. They got a cash cow, so they want to keep milking it. That is the problem, because we and you and I, when we go and speak, we're speaking to successful companies. They're not ready for your message, and they don't encapsulate failure. So what they want to know, because they're so risk averse, is they're like, please, Ozan, tell us how to capture failure through some sort of grassroots meeting where we can like document things and put it in a knowledge management database. And like 2 years later, we'll like learn and have best practice. No, man, fuck that. They're stupid. What they should be saying is, let's just try shit. Let's just try and try and try and fail and fail and fail. And we have to believe that in our culture, it will become so ingrained that we are a company that tries stuff, that we will learn from it, that there will be enough people around here who stick through it, that they know that's what we do. And so at Walmart, Sam Walton's been dead for 20 years. And you know what? It's still what we do. And I don't even work at Walmart anymore. I worked there for 10 years, but I loved it. And I was director of leadership development there. And I can tell you, that's what we do. We try stuff and we fail at it and we get better.
I think that observation is spot on, because success tends to boost egos and breed complacency, right? So, you know, the last Fast and Furious movie succeeded, so let's just make another sequel, another sequel, another sequel, another sequel. Just keep looking at the rearview mirror and do what we did yesterday, which can work in the short term, right? Like, that can actually be a successful strategy in the short term, but it's a recipe for long-term disaster. I'm writing a book right now related to rocket science, which harkens back to my past, but and one of the sad things I think about space exploration is that you had this big boom in the 1960s with the space race, which, you know, the Americans won, and then NASA just got complacent. It kept doing what it did yesterday, launching the same types of missions, using the same processes, you know, launching stuff first to the moon, but then we just settled for low Earth orbit. And then space exploration somehow got boring, right? Like, this supremely inspiring thing got boring. And now, of course, we were seeing the rise of private companies like SpaceX, young, hungry, scrappy, coming in and really dazzling the world with audacious goals that they're slowly working towards.
What an incredible observation, and I totally agree. And what I'm trying to pull away from for organizations, whether they're rocket scientists or not, is don't feel like you need to document everything when it comes to failure. Just try to fail a little bit more and a little bit quicker and a little bit harder and a little bit faster, and try it for low cost and low risk and whatever you can, and just keep going, because it'll just become part of your way of working. And the way, the metaphor I'll give you on that is like literally the T-1000, right? Like the bad guy in the movie Terminator 2. Where when you shoot him, because he's made out of liquid metal, he just like heals over, right? Like he just reseals. And only a vat of liquid steel in an empty warehouse could finally kill him. So there are some things to avoid. You don't want to ride your car with no seatbelt and risk that kind of failure. But if you can be like the T-1000 and take those bullets and keep walking, then actually that is the person who is the most successful. They just have more bullet wounds to show for it.
Well, Neil, we're almost coming to the end of our time here, but I want to give you the opportunity to share some parting words on failure, anecdotes, really anything that you think we should have covered.
Yeah, you know what? Here's something I was thinking about. You know, I knew we were going to have this conversation, and I was thinking a little about failure, and I thought of one that I hadn't had a chance to share yet on the show, but I think it's really interesting, and maybe not an obvious one, but a lot of your listeners are probably readers and maybe some authors and so on, like what we're talking about. Here's something interesting. My first book was called The Book of Awesome, okay? People bought it for their parents. They bought it for their teachers at Christmas. They bought it for each other. They bought it for friends in the hospital who were sick, blah, blah, blah. I didn't realize it at the time, but the book was eminently giftable. Because when you buy a book called The Book of Awesome, what you're telling the gift recipient is you are awesome. Similarly, when you buy a book called You Are a Badass, you're telling them, hey, you are a badass. When you say The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck, you're saying, hey, man, you're totally chill. Like you can zen out with this book or whatever. You're giving someone a present that's a little bit more expensive than a greeting card, but communicates a value. Now, why am I telling you that? Because in my fifth book, I made a horrible mistake. I titled my book, The Happiness Equation. Am I proud of the book? Yeah. Is it selling well? Sure. But what happened was when the book came out, people started saying, oh, can you sign up for my husband? And then they're like, no, actually, don't do that. Just sign your name. And I was like, why? And they're like, well, if I give it to my husband, he's going to think that I don't think he's happy. He's going to think that I want him to be happy. He's going to think that I'm trying to change him. And so what I inadvertently did is I essentially took a winning property that I had, the Book of Awesome and sequels, and I totally killed it by saying, giving people a title that they could no longer gift. So why is that an interesting failure? Because, well, yes, the sales were not the same as Book of Awesome, they were lower. And I think a big part of it is you could not give that to your teacher. You could not give that as easily to someone in the hospital because it seems like you're kind of pushing them a little too much. So the insight I had on this, and I'm kind of having this through you kind of asking me to be on the show, is it is also possible to have success and then walk into a totally unanticipated failure later. So be wary of change. That doesn't mean don't keep trying to fail fast, blah, blah, blah. Don't keep trying new things. But like, what other things are you doing today in your behaviors that you are taking for granted as a given, but actually which are the result of a totally maybe random or lucky guess by yourself? Can you consciously try to see those in a way that helps make you a little more anti-fragile going forward?
That's great advice. I was reading somewhere, I don't remember where, but we'll put the article in the show notes if I can find it, that Mark Manson's book was initially going to be titled Negative Self-Help. And if it had been titled that, I don't think it would have sold, you know, millions of copies that The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck has sold, precisely for the reason that you mentioned.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, Neil, this was so much fun. Thank you so much for joining us. Where can people find you online and check out your podcast?
The podcast is at 3books.co, or just typing in 3books into iTunes or Spotify or YouTube or Stitcher, all these other new things, which I can't say I fully understand how they all work, but I just know podcasts or whatever podcasts are bought and sold or whatever, they are downloaded. And then for me, I'm actually totally happy to just give out my email address, because I always feel like there's a special, unique community of people that listen all the way to the end of the podcast. And if you made it this far, and if you resonate with anything I said, or if you have any questions, like literally, please feel free to drop me a line at Neil, N-E-I-L, at globalhappiness.org. So it's Neil at globalhappiness.org, globalhappiness.org. Why do I just give out my email address like out of there? I know that's totally weird and nobody does that. It's because literally the people that are like here right now listening to this, those are my favorite kind of people. So if you made it this far and you're like listening to the show, like drop me a line. I always love hearing from people. I'd love to answer any questions or just talk.
Yeah, those are the people that read all the way to the acknowledgments section, right?
That's what Seth Godin and I talk about on that podcast you were talking about.
Well, thank you so much, Neil, for joining us, for your time, for your generosity and sharing your email address. And to the members of the audience who've listened this far, thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for listening. Two things before you take off. First, if you don't want to miss out on future episodes of Famous Failures, please subscribe to the podcast on whatever platform you're listening on, and be sure to leave a review on iTunes or Google Play. Second, if you'd like to join thousands of others who receive a short email from me each Thursday with a list of articles, books, tools, quotes, and other gems that help you discover how extraordinary thinking produces extraordinary results, you can text my first name, which is Ozan, that's spelled O-Z-A-N, to 345-345. So once again, that's my first name, Ozan, O-Z-A-N, to 345-345. Or if you're in front of your computer, you can head over to ozanvarol.com and drop your email address. If you act now, you'll also get a free ebook called The Contrarian Handbook, 8 Principles to Innovate Your Thinking. As always, thank you for listening and see you next time.